From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nanette Watts gives ghost tours in Salt Lake City. She takes people around the area in a bus, and she shows them the haunted houses and tells the stories that come along with them. Now, Nanette believes in ghosts, though she doesn't exactly understand just how it works. And she says her job isn't to make other people believers. I don't define that for people, she says. I'm just here to tell the stories. So the truth, the rational explanation, doesn't much matter to a storyteller like Nanette. She tells people you don't have to believe in ghosts to believe a good ghost story. So today in the program, pretty much everyone is welcome. Skeptics, believers, because we're telling ghost stories. But not just that. We're also talking about how they work and what they mean. So we hope you'll join us today after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we're talking about ghost stories. So let's begin with one. It comes from Adam Sherlock. He's a teacher and radio producer here in Salt Lake City. And it's a story that played out here in Utah in Davis County.
So the hospital I used to work at was one of those old rundown linoleum and cinder block buildings that they built back in the 70s. It had been a rest home for the elderly before being converted in the mid-90s into a secure care facility for mentally disturbed youth. For safety, every room had a motion-activated camera in it, and the staff control room had a series of monitors to record and watch back in the event of an incident. Even without the hospital's creepy history, it was easy to get an unsettling feeling walking the halls at night. Patients had talked about seeing a girl floating past the window of the cafeteria, or hearing singing come from one of the empty seclusion rooms that we used for behavioral issues. One frozen winter night, I came back from taking out the trash, and as I was walking back towards the control room, a patient called out to me from his room. I leaned in his doorway, talking to him about his upcoming home visit. I could hear the motion detectors that we turn on after curfew going off down the hall, and knew that I was the one setting it off. After a minute, I heard one of the other staff call down to me, "What's he doing in there? Get him away from the window." The patient I was talking to was the only one in the room, so I assumed that there was something else going on in one of the others. After I finished, I went to the control desk and asked what was going on. "Who is in that room with you two?" the team leader asked. I replied that no one was there. "Look," he said, rewinding the tape. Although it was a little grainy, in a strange angle, perched in the corner above the bathroom door, it was plain to see the patient in bed, my silhouette framed by his doorway, and a third figure leaning against the wall behind the bed. The figure then slid in a very strange way behind the curtain of the window, so only its slim legs could be seen. It slid further towards the window where it became obscured by a dresser, and then was gone. The five staff huddled around the monitor turned and looked at me. The silence was suffocating, and I shook my head. That wasn't in the room. "I didn't see that," I said. Everyone sat silent, and then our team lead said, "Maybe it was a ghost." The instant that she said that, every monitor detector on the unit rang out simultaneously, and not just in the patients' rooms. The day room, the seclusion room, utility closets, rooms that no one had been in for hours. The computer screeched at us, insisting that there was something moving in each of them. Everyone was in a state of uncontrollable panic, and someone dove under the desk and unplugged the whole system. Once it was plugged back in, the tapes were blank and the unit was silent.
It's a story from Adam Sherlock. Adam is actually joining us right now. He teaches radio documentary at Spy Hop Productions, joining us by phone. Adam, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess what I wanted to know is you've talked about the fact that in some ways these stories are... Well, your hunch is in some way that these are ghosts who ghosts want to tell stories, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that that's what happened to us that night was that after, the pandemonium subsided, everyone was sitting around sort of charting and filing paperwork, and everyone started telling their own stories, and everyone had one. We had, some staff who... had worked as an organ harvester in a hospital who had a really creepy story, and someone else lived on supposedly the site of an, Indian massacre or something. And it made me realize that we all, you know, ghosts are this great, ghost stories are this great sort of catalyst to get us to tell these kinds of stories. And I think that's part of the legend, too, right? If you think about something like George C. Scott's The Changeling, right? It's like the ghost wants its story told. It wants people to know about it. And we do that every time we're around a campfire.
Yeah. Well, Adam, thanks. Good story.
Thank you.
Well, today in the program, in honor of the occasion, we're telling ghost stories. We've asked listeners to share some of them, so we'll be playing some, reading some if we have the time. We're also talking about these stories, asking how they work and what they mean. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Lynn McNeil, who she teaches folklore at Utah State University, which includes a class on the supernatural. And Lynn McNeil, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
So let me ask you this first. Have there, like throughout human history, have there always been stories about ghosts?
Yeah. I mean, there have always been stories about the things that we can't explain because there have always been things that we can't explain. And, you know, it's an easy assumption a lot of people make that as we grow in our understanding of how science works, that our ghost stories and our supernatural legends will fade away. And that has been proven 100% wrong. We have gained incredible scientific knowledge, and we still tell ghost stories left, right, and center all the time, not just at this time of year,
and
all times of year.
So we just adapt them, right?
Yeah.
If we come up with some kind of explanation. But what does that mean, that there is an answer? We find some kind of, you know, rational answer for a lot of this stuff, or some of the stuff anyway, but we still choose to go with the story that doesn't have the explanation. What does that say about us, do you think?
Well, I think initially what it says about us is that we really love a good story.
Yeah.
And we really love a good mystery. We like it when things are explained. We like when we come to understand something that we previously didn't understand. But once we understand it, it's sort of like, okay, ho-hum. We're over that now. What's new? What don't we still get? And ghosts for a long time have been a thing that we don't get, and we continue to talk about them.
Mm. You know, Adam mentioned this idea that ghosts have – and I want to work through this with all of our guests. We're going to have some other guests here come in a moment. But with you, Lynn, first this question, this idea that ghosts have a story that they want told. What do you make of that?
You know, Adam's story was great because it's one of those kinds of stories that features a real confluence of evidence in things. So we have the good historical setup for where this is taking place. We have a good creepy environment at night with motion sensors. We have technological evidence, which everyone just adores when it comes to ghosts. You know, monitors capturing something that the human eye can't see. And then we have the personal sort of numinous mystical experience of one individual at the center of this. And you bring all those things together and you start to go, man, there's got to be something going on here. Something wants attention. Something wants to be known. And I think that's an idea that a lot of people like, is that there's not just ghosts out there, but that they want us to know about them, and they want us to find them, and they want us to understand them.
So it seems like it's like they're organic, these different – so you talked about the structure there. And it's not as if somebody who tells a ghost story says, all right, I'm going to build a basic structure which has this and has this. So it seems like in some ways it's almost – and it's almost like it's like an urban legend, mm-hmm. that it takes on a certain kind of dynamic. And some of these stories, especially the ones that aren't firsthand, seem that they don't really come from anywhere in particular, right? I mean, they're a story that came from a friend of a friend of an uncle. Right? Is that the way it works in some ways? It's just organic to who we are as storytellers?
Yeah, in a lot of ways it is. And I think what happens, and we see this examples of it from all over folk culture, like you mentioned, urban legends as well as ghost stories. And we have a cultural language for talking about things we don't understand. So when we experience something that we can't explain, we've heard ghost stories, we've heard third-person stories, we've heard other people tell us their experiences, and that provides us with this traditional language to speak about this stuff. And it's interesting because there's an assumption that a lot of people just leap to supernatural conclusions. You know, there's a strange unexplained noise or a book falls off the shelf, and people who are, you know, all geeked about ghost stories just go, oh, haunted. My house is haunted.
Yeah.
And really they rarely do that. And we even heard that in Adam's story. There's sort of a consideration of what else could this have been? What could explain this? Nothing else could explain this. And then we fill in the blanks of our scientific understanding with traditional understanding, which tells us that some buildings are haunted and some spirits are lingering, and that is what can explain these occurrences.
So culture gives a story a kind of structure. It gives it a language.
Yeah, it does. And then we apply that structure and that language to the unique personal experiences that we have. You know, folklorists distinguish between the legend as a genre of narrative, which is third person, and the memorat is the word that folklorists use to describe the first person experience. And we tend to use the language of legends in our first person stories because that's how we understand them. That's how we comprehend them. And some people are glad when they find language to explain something they couldn't explain. A friend says, oh, yeah, that's an apparition. Or, oh, yeah, what you're seeing in this photograph is an orb or a vortex indicating ghosts. And people are right. glad to have that language filled in for them.
I'm wondering if in a culture like Utah, you know, where there's a predominant culture, Mormon mm-hmm. culture, do the stories take on sort of a cast of Mormon theology or Mormon expression? Do you see that?
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think largely what we see is story types that exist elsewhere but that have localized explanations. So many, many cultures have stories of visits from recently deceased relatives and, you know, people who've passed on before. And we also see, especially in Utah, but also around the world, stories of pre-birth visitation, spirits coming of children before they've been born. And that happens. Those stories exist outside of Utah, but they exist especially in Utah because there's sort of that setting for that to take place within the dominant culture here.
Yeah. We have a few of those that sort of play into let me actually play one because I think it's interesting that there are a couple of dynamics in this story which I think is interesting. This comes from a woman named Alicia who sent this story from Orem. Let's play this and I want to talk about it because she tells the story and then she kind of explains what she takes from it, which I think is interesting. Here's Alicia.
It happened several years ago when my oldest son, who's now almost 10, he was then about a year old. We were living in a basement in Springville, and my husband told me this a couple years after it happened, and he still was kind of like just relieved from it. He said one night we were both asleep in bed, and this was an odd bed room. It was essentially like someone's big family room, but they turned it into a bedroom. So it's a big master bedroom. And on one end we had our bed, and on the other end we had our son's crib. And he said for some reason he woke up and he looked across the room, and there looking into the crib was an older lady. And he's like, there's no way anyone could have gotten into the room. And then he realized that she wasn't standing on the floor. She was above the ground a little bit. And that her clothes were like period time clothes. They were late 1800s. And she had some kind of like a shawl or a bonnet on, something over her head, you know. And she was in a long dress. And he said it had an apron on it. Anyway, so he could tell this was not just someone who'd broken in the house and gotten in. She was looking over into the crib. And then she turned around and looked at him. And he said then she started to come towards him, and as she was coming towards him, she started going up vertically. By the time she reached him, she went up to the ceiling and was gone. It took a year or two at least to gone by before he told me anything about it. I think we were still living in Springville. We just moved out of that house at that point in time. We only spent about 9 months in that house. I don't know if it was someone that he was related to, you know, or if it was just somebody that had to do with the house there, or if it was that area. Yeah, we never did learn.
That's not the greatest quality there. That's very creepy, actually. Very appropriate, I think. But Alicia goes on to say that she's not this timid soul and that she is normally not really, afraid of things. But she says this kind of thing freaks her out. And she says, here's how she explains why she gets freaked out by something like that.
I believe that we exist before and we exist after we die. I'm not sure in what form and how and where and why. I don't know, maybe that's why it scares me, because I don't know why, and it bothers me. It's one of those weird things.
So I won't venture a guess on her religious affiliation, but she, you know, she's believes that people live before. This is a very typical Mormon belief that people lived before they existed before, and they existed after. Does that fit into that sort of – here's her cultural sort of – she's making something of that culturally?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she gave us a great example of that rational process that people go through of, okay, what time period is she dressed in and what is she wearing and what could her affiliation be, a past relative or a past resident of the house or a resident of the area, sort of trying to figure out what could this be, where could this come from, and now fitting this experience into my larger worldview. How does this fit with what I understand about how the world works and how the universe works, and does it promote my beliefs or does it contradict my beliefs? And then what do I do with that, and how do I feel now about this experience in the light of that? So that's an excellent example of the way that we take an experience that another person might interpret quite differently with a different cultural background or a different worldview.
This is a question that you – I'm going to give you the opportunity to not answer this question if you don't want to. But I have to ask it, and I know in some ways it probably doesn't matter, but do you believe in ghosts? Or how do you handle that question? Whether you answer it or not.
That's a better question.
Yeah.
How does a folklorist handle that question?
Exactly.
Because one of the big things, of course, that a folklorist, when working with people who are sharing their folk culture with them, does not want to do is alienate anyone. If I walk into any particular encounter with someone with whom I'm doing field work as either just a complete disbelieving skeptic or just a complete sold, I'm in, you know, I believe this, I risk negating their perspective and their experience. So, and I think I'm not lying when I genuinely say I am open to all possibilities. I have yet to see what I would say constitutes 100% unequivocal proof that ghosts exist. But I don't think we're meant to get that. I don't think we're going to. I don't think we'd want it. I think we'd all be really sad if we figured out how ghosts work and it were just, you know, a humdrum scientific thing like how, you know, cellular division works. That would just become really boring. And so I don't necessarily want that proof, but I have absolutely had experiences that I can't explain that in the light of folk culture make more sense when I learn things about where I am and who's been there before me. And I have heard from innumerable trustworthy, intelligent, rational people who have seen what constitutes proof for them. And that's one of the biggest selling points in my mind, is that it's one thing when you hear a story with no personal attachment and you can scoff at it and kind of be like, yeah, whatever, okay, those people are nuts. But when someone that you trust implicitly, someone whose intelligence and rationality you are familiar with and admiring of, when they tell you, this is what happened, this is how I felt about it, this is what I think was going on, you can't argue that. You don't want to argue it. You want it to be truth.
Lynn McNeil is with us. She teaches folklore at Utah State University, and we invite you to join us if you have, well, stories or questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, in honor of the occasion, we're telling ghost stories. Over the last few days, we've been collecting them, so we're going to share some of them today. We're also trying to figure out just how they work, ghost stories, talking about, you know, where they come from, what they mean, what they have in common. Lynn McNeil is joining us. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. Let me also introduce Linda Dunning. She's the creator of the Utah History and Hauntings series. It's a collection of books. She's written four of them so far, and the most recent is called Ghost Lights. And Linda Dunning, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Nanette Watts is also joining us here in the studio. She's a storyteller and a guide with Salt Lake City Ghost Tours. And Nanette, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start with I want to go to a story that comes from a man by the name of Doug Ashby. He and his family worked at This Is the Place State Monument for a number of years, right? Wait, Linda, what are you laughing for? Is there a lot of ghosts up there?
My new book, I had written up the Heritage Park stories in 2003, and I wrote them again. They have a new management, and so the stories are in there, but I would put it on the top 10 most haunted areas in Utah.
Wow.
Along with Gardner Village and, you know, any place where they've got a collection of pioneer buildings that they've moved from all over the state and put in one place.
Yeah, which they have here.
And then they're building replicas, which would attract ghosts because they're replicas of the other buildings, you know. So you can't really deny a 100-year or 150-year history of ghost stories about a place. When I'm mainly, you know, researching the history and the stories behind them. And when you have piles of stories, you cannot say that you don't have any.
Yeah.
You do have a lot of stories there.
Well, here's one. So. This comes from Douglas Ashby, and he's talking about an experience actually that happened to his father, whom I think he calls in the piece the Ancient One. And this was an experience that happens at Brigham Young's Forest Farmhouse. This happens when the park was closed, and his father was working on the second floor, and another man was working in the basement. And as he came up the stairs, he ran into a woman. And this woman was dressed in pioneer garb, and she looked at him silently, and she smiled sweetly, and then she walked on.
So they went down to the front door, and it was locked. They says, well, we better find her. So they searched the entire house, from the bedrooms and the ballroom on the second floor down to the kitchen and the pantry and the den and the other rooms on the main floor. They even went down and checked the basement, and they could find no one. And when they got back up to the living room, the parlor, my father, the Ancient One, said, what did this woman look like? And the man says, oh, she was about 5'2" or 5'3", had dark gray hair. She was wearing a pioneer dress, as our women do up here during the season. And my father said, isn't that a little strange that she would wear a pioneer dress when it's off season? And they started looking around, and the man noticed a picture of Brigham Young and several of his wives. And he pointed out Anna Eliza Webb Young, a woman who had been seen many times in that house, even though she's been dead over 100 years, and said, that is the woman that I bumped into in the kitchen.
Okay, now we got an email from Connie, who writes a story. She says, there was a big party in my great-grandfather's house. A young man was attracted to a woman that he saw at the party. And there's a similarity here, Lynn, and I wanted you to talk about this. So Connie writes, this young man is very attracted to this woman, and he wants to meet her again. So he kept describing her to people because he wanted to find out her name. And since many guests lived far away, they were invited to spend the night. Already, you're hearing things already. And the next morning, the guests were taken on a tour of the house. And as they went downstairs, they were approaching a landing where there was a portrait of a young woman. And the young man shouted out, that's the woman I was talking about. My great-grandfather said, but that's not possible. She's been dead for 50 years. Okay, in Doug Ashby's story and in Connie's story there, there's a photo of realization. Is this a motif?
Oh, yes. It's a very, very common motif. It's a common motif in ghost stories. It's a common motif in urban legends, the story of the vanishing hitchhiker, where a young girl is picked up on the side of the road and gives her destination and is driven there. And when they arrive, they turn around and there's no girl in the back seat. She's gone. And when they go to the house to investigate, often it's either there's a picture or she's left something behind, or they describe her and get confirmation that this is a young woman who died however many years ago. They, of course, discover after the fact that they were driving a ghost in the backseat of their car. And I think this motif is so popular because it's exactly the sort of titillating evidence that we want. You know, it's one thing to have spotted a person who looked out of place or whatever, and then they never reappear.
Yeah.
It's another thing to see evidence that that is a person who could not have been present at that time. And that's really, I think the stories we like are not just the creepy, mysterious ones, but the stories we like are the creepy, mysterious ones with that extra twist of evidence, of
implausibility.
Of
it was impossible for her to have been dead.
Exactly.
She's been dead. Nanette, do you see that? Do you see those kinds of stories as you encounter stories?
Definitely. We have a story on our tour about the kissing tree in Salt Lake, and it comes out of a pioneer journal. And this was either a great storyteller who lived it beyond his death to his family, or this is the original vanishing hitchhiker here in Salt Lake City.
How does it play out? What's the basic story?
He finds her he gave her his jacket. They shared an electrifying kiss under the kissing tree, where the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers have a monument where an insensitive soul tore the tree down. But they shared that kiss, and the next day he goes back to find her. The house looks different, and he's sent up to the cemetery, and his jacket is laying there folded on the grave waiting for him.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to make too much of these stories beyond the fact that they're just – that's so great. But do you get a sense of where they begin? Is it because someone is trying to kind of figure something out? They're going through a moment of heartbreak or grief or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think it's hard to talk about the origin of these stories because often we don't hear them until they've been passed around quite some time, you know, until they can become general enough. So speculations about origins are sort of tricky. But when we talk about ghost stories, there's really two possible origins from that they might stem from. And one is that they might come from a cultural source, meaning someone started this, we assume, at some point, and it resonates with us on a level that is psychologically or personally or spiritually meaningful.
Yeah.
And so that's the story that picks up, that gets told, that gets spread. And the source remains within some level of cultural expectation or appreciation. Or we have these stories because they originate from experience, because something happened and continues to happen. And this is perhaps where we get this idea that ghosts want something from us. I mean, it seems that there are a lot of them leaving their sweaters around to indicate that they've been hanging out with us. And I think it's not completely out of line to say, all right, well, either that is a meaningful cultural point for us, or that is something that is happening.
Linda, what do you think?
Well, I wanted to talk about Memory Grove because Memory Grove has a whole history of how the ghost story has changed over the decades, about every 20 years. First, there were mills in Memory Grove, and there was an old story about a miller's daughter either killing herself or being, you know, killed in a mill. And that was around. And then it became Memory Grove Park. And then there was the famous bride who ran through the park. And either she was hit by a car or she lost her fiancé.
Yeah.
That went on for when I was young. That was one of the ones that was going on. And then...
And she would go around weeping or something?
Yeah. She would run through the trees and go up to the pagoda up there and then disappear in the trees. Well, then in the 60s and 70s, it became Bloody Mary with an axe and, you know, and it...
So it took on a more sinister turn.
Well, it follows the park because the park got run down during that time.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of people there and it got run down, and then it was Bloody Mary for 20 years. And then in the early 90s, it became dimension doors hanging up in the pine trees. And people could travel back and forth between these dimension doors.
Awesome.
And then the tornado came, knocked the trees down at the end of the 1990s. And then it started to become ley lines and what do you call those, vortexes. And now you have a lot of ghost investigation groups getting EVPs and stuff because they, you know, they can hear these people calling through the dimension doors or the... So there's been this whole thing throughout the history of the park that parallels this ghost stories. So it's really interesting to follow that and see that. So
we adapt, right, Lynn?
Oh, yes, we adapt, and we adapt our what we determine to be evidence, what we determine to be proof, the use of EVP, electronic voice phenomena, as a way of determining the presence of ghosts and spirits is something that contemporary society loves. We don't believe it unless there's scientific proof, right?
Yeah.
We want our evidence to be replicable and scientific and objective. And boy, is it hard to make ghosts be replicable and scientific and objective. And despite, I'm sure many people have seen television shows and read books by ghost hunters and things like that, despite all of this emphasis on objective evidence, what constitutes proof for most people of the supernatural is personal experience.
Yeah.
And that just is so contrary to our modern scientific thinking. You know, we don't believe in science because of personal experience. We believe in it because of objective studies that get published in respectable journals. And when it comes to believing in ghosts and spirits, the best evidence is you know where you were, you know what you were doing, you know what you felt, you know what you saw. And that's what makes people believe.
And I think there's two kinds. There are private stories that have evidence for the family and for the people and their spiritual stories. And then there are the public stories that travel throughout history, and you have the backup of a lot of history with them. And I think the private personal stories stay with people because those are the ones that they feel have proof, you know, for themselves, for their personal, for themselves personally. But the public ones, they're all over the place.
Yeah. So, Nanette, go ahead.
I was going to say that we have that trouble replicating on the tours. You can't gauge a night when there will be activity. Some people come because we don't pretend to be the Walking Dead. I look like I do now. I'm a storyteller. I'm not a ghost hunter. Yeah. I tell the local lore, first or secondhand experience. And we encourage people to bring their cameras because it's that proof that Lynn is talking about. We have that proof on somebody's camera. And I always say, please share with everybody else because nothing will be happening except for the stories. And some people go home thinking, oh, nothing happened. When some people go home thinking, tons happened on that tour.
What's the difference? Someone's more receptive, you think, or more inclined to want to believe something? Do you understand it?
How it's been explained to me is I started 11 years ago running these tours, and I was petrified of ghosts and the what ifs. And my dad said, Sugar, just relax and go have fun. And that's what I do. I'm not the Walking Dead. I'm not looking for someone's body. I like my own. And I just tell these stories, and we have a lot of fun. So on my tours, you'll have a lot of fun hearing the stories and the history, why the ghosts might be haunting. I try not to explain things away for people because – and some people, if I have – like up at This Is the Place, I was telling a story up there once, and a woman stood me down. She just spoke right up on the bus because I had people say, that couldn't be her. She was a prominent LDS figure. Yeah. And this lady said, I have seen her.
Well, Brigham Young haunted the Heritage Park or the Forest Farmhouse when it was in the city. And then when it moved up to, you know, up to the park, then it became Eliza, mm-hmm. you know. And so it moved, you know, and he completely disappeared. And she shows up.
And she's at the Lion House.
And there's about five of them. There's about five just in the important ones in that house, and then there's a ton in a lot of other houses.
Wow. So. Lynn, you were going to say.
Yeah, just on that distinction, which I think is really apt between the sort of public, broad, historical-based perhaps story and the personal experience that maybe only has meaning or evidence on a personal level, there are folk customs that actually bridge those two things. And I think it's one of the reasons that ghost tours are so wonderful and popular is what folklorists call legend tripping, mm-hmm. where you basically make an excursion to a site that's purported to be haunted or that's known to have creepy stuff happen. And this is really popular, of course, among adolescents and college students. And so we see a lot of it up in Logan, where I'm teaching. But we take the public story and make our own personal version of it. So at the, you know, Logan Cemetery, we have the haunted weeping woman statue, popular site for college students to go legend tripping. They go visit, they've heard the public story, and then they create their own experience. And there's a variety of ways that you can invoke a response from the weeping woman. And when that happens, or when you perceive that something happens, usually, and I imagine this is true on ghost tours too, enthusiasm and panic are very contagious. One person spots something and it changes the whole experience for everyone else.
The actual story about the weeping woman in Logan comes from a really poignant pioneer story where a man lost several of his children and his wife, and then they were buried around the weeping, you know, the weeping statue. And I went up there to investigate, and there's a lot of stories about all of those children dying consecutively every 2 years and all this. But when you go and see it, none of that is true. But it's very poignant because after she passed away after all the children – or I'm sorry, he passed away and she was left. And they used to take her up there. You know, she would go up there every year and visit her children, everything. And so there's a poignant story behind it, and then it became this other thing.
Yeah.
And it's a huge statue in the middle of the cemetery, so it's an amazing, you know, there can be all kinds of stories about it.
Well, I want to play one that comes from it's so interesting how much loss plays into these. You know, someone tragically losing their life or suicide often comes into to a lot of these, and despair. It's really interesting. There's a story that comes from Denver Olmsted. She tells a story from the Vernal Cemetery that she's familiar with. Here it is.
There was a young couple that were settlers within that area that came and were very much in love. And the gentleman was a doctor, and the woman was beautiful, of course. They loved each other very much. And unfortunately, an illness came through the area, and she died suddenly. And the story goes that he didn't know how he would live without being able to see her every day. And so he built a tombstone that's made out of metal. It stands maybe about 3 feet high. And before she was buried, he cut off her head and placed it into a pickle jar and placed it inside of this metal tombstone that is there. And you can still walk up there today and go, and there's a little door that you can lift and open up to see her head. And it's said that if you go up there late in the evening, usually with a nice bright moon, and you go up and lift the handle, you'll be able to look into her eyes and you'll see her body rise from this grave, and she'll be asking to have her head be replaced so that she can be back with her husband that she loves so much. I did do it in high school. It was one of those things of where a gentleman told me the story. Go up late at night, scare the girl, fall into his arms. I won't say who that was.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is, and I guess you get this motif a lot, Lynn McNeil, where there's an actual landmark and somebody creates a story to be connected to the landmark, like in this case, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Though the more organic it is, the better. You know, we have a sense that the story has been handed down to us from time immemorial, right? You know, someone didn't just make it up and then expect us to care about it. It's that,
as the story goes.
Exactly. It's that, you know, it's true, this happened. And I think that the sort of coda to her story of she experienced it with a gentleman wanting her to, you know, fall into his arms in fright, that's an incredibly common theme. Yeah. I mean, legend-tripping instances do nothing if not bring the people who share them closer together. I think that's one reason that we see it happening among a lot of young people. Nothing bonds you faster than almost dying at the hands of a ghost. Right. And romantic encounters often go there sort of to heighten the emotional nature of the evening. Yeah. You know, it's a great way to suddenly find yourself clutching another person.
You know, it's interesting that idea of there being a landmark and an actual landmark, something where people can actually see. I'm thinking of Kay's Cross.
Oh, Kay's Cross. Yes,
one.
There's a whole history about Kay's Cross.
Yeah. And what are some of the ones I heard just recently, as a matter of fact, because this was one of the places where I used to go when I wanted to frighten people. But was it an angry polygamist had killed all his wives? Have you heard that one?
Well, there's a whole bunch of stories, but I think some of the real stories are greater because there was a spinoff group from Bountiful that started a polygamy group up in that area. And he's the man that built Kay's Cross. And a lot of
So there is some truth here.
Yeah, a lot of his – it was a huge cross. It was like 21 feet high or something like that. Anyway, the children got into it. People would come by to see the ghost, so they'd dress in sheets and shoot off fireworks. And the children that lived in that area, that lived in the polygamist group, would go up there and do all this stuff to scare people up there. But it was really sad because I think it was 1990, I'll probably have the date wrong, but about 1994, somebody blew it up because there were so many stories and people were going there that they just wanted to get rid of it. So they, but they used to have a whole thing. You had to go through the cemetery, down the hill, up the hill, down to Kay's Cross.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a lot of different stories. Like one is there's a woman there and that just comes out at night, and there's people up in the trees in the cemetery. But the best one, and that's the early one I think you're referring to, it was in the late 1800s when a man buried one of his polygamist wives there and then started burying all of them there. So there's a whole bunch of stories about it.
Bennett, do you know of any other sort of monument stories that are connected to monuments that people can go to and see, and there's a story connected to it?
One of the most famous in Salt Lake is Emo's ghost, grave. And we actually got eyes just a couple weeks ago. I took 75 Girl Scouts up there, and the picture's on our website, storytours.com.
Eyes in the image or something?
Eyes right behind the grate where his urn used to be. He's now, his ashes have been moved to an undisclosed location because of vandalism.
Yeah.
But the story is still there and there are still happenings. We've had a lot of proof from video, EVP, and we've had shadows coming out right as people are looking in.
But it comes from an early story of a Jewish man and a Mormon guy.
Right, we tell that story on the tour.
And, you know, fighting with each other. And
no, it was two Jewish men. It was Simon Bamberger who ran against Jacob Mormon.
Yeah, exactly. The governor? The former governor.
And so what's funny is
they got buried next to each, almost next to each other. That's what was funny.
It's a very narrow path, and that's what we tell, is that where some people think he was a devil worshiper and a cult leader, and he was. He wrote the Utah Constitution. No. He helped.
Yeah.
So we tell the real story and then doesn't take away from the ghostly experiences.
That's a really common legend narrating experience that we just got to hear there, where people will join in. You know, that one of the most beautiful things about folklore is that it sort of belongs equally to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, we all get to share this. So there's a lot of, no, it was this, and clarifying and you know, comparing versions of the narrative. And that sort of participatory nature in a lot of this, I think, is what makes it so appealing to a lot of people. It's not like reading literature where there's one correct version of this story. There's variations and
this is how I heard it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's true. After every tour, I have to stand for half an hour talking and listening to people sharing their version or their stories.
It's because people want to
Here's an email from comes from Nola, a story that comes from Nola in Kearns, Utah. My mother grew up in a small farming town in southeastern Idaho, surrounded by relatives. She related the story about one of her cousins. He was a young man just getting ready to go on an LDS mission and was found one evening in the basement of their house, hanging by electrical wires. A tragic death like this was a shock enough for the family, but to compound it, authorities were ready to call it a suicide. The family was up in arms about this, for they believed there was absolutely no reason he would have had to take his own life. Nola writes, a few days after his death, he appeared to his younger brother in their bedroom. He asked his brother to tell their parents that it was indeed an accident. He said that he had been trying to tell them, but they were so upset they were not listening. After he had given his message, Nola writes, he disappeared and was not seen again. You have to see that kind of story a lot, right? Right? Oh. And then trying to make amends or clear up a story.
You know, a lot of hauntings are perceived to come from sort of the unfinished business model, whether it's what happened was so terrible that you're sort of bound to that place, or whether it's I need to clear something up, I need to get a point across or set something right. And I think it's also a great example of how many, many ghost stories are very happy, might not be the right word, but peaceful and positive in their nature. We sort of like at Halloween time, especially the gore and the scary stuff and the frightening images and ideas. But a lot of ghost stories that we actually hear are of people finding peace, or someone sharing that they are at rest or that everything's okay now. And that serves a really important purpose, I think, for a lot of communities and families.
Lynn McNeil is with us. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. Linda Dunning is the author of Ghost Lights, is the fourth in her Utah History and Haunting series. Nanette Watts is with us, a guide with Salt Lake City Ghost Tours. And we need to take a break. Thank you, by the way, for those of you who have shared your stories. You can continue the conversation. Just go to our website and you can tell your own stories and read some more of the stories. They're really terrific. But we'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling ghost stories. After the last few days, we've been collecting some of them, and so we're trying to share some of them today. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Lynn McNeil is with us here. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. Also, the writer Linda Dunning is with us. She's on her fourth in her Utah History and Haunting series, book series. And Nanette Watts is a guide with Salt Lake City Ghost Tour. She's here with us as well. Let's take a call. Anne is with us in Salt Lake. Anne, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Well, Angeline's ghost story that happened to my husband and I about 3 years ago when we were visiting our son and his wife. They left to get groceries. Both of us were totally awake in their living room. We looked across the room to the wall that separates the living room from the dining room. It became very misty, and about 20 people came through the wall. They didn't have clearly defined faces. We didn't hear their voices, but the message was very clear. This is a wonderful home. We're glad your son and wife live there.
Wow, that's terrific.
That's amazing. Yeah. 20 people.
It's really, what I like about the story, and thanks, Anne, very much for sharing it, it's connected to another one told to us by Bob Nelson. He's, of course, a reporter, host of the program All Things Considered. And he told a great story about his brother, who's since passed away. But he and his wife, who had a house, or were looking at a house over on Roosevelt. This is in Salt Lake City. And they had come to meet the woman who owned the house. They were charmed by it. It was a lovely house. And she told them the story about how she had drawn up this house and her husband had built this house for her. It was her dream house, really. And it's a really terrific story, and it has kind of a lovely end to it. Let's hear it. This is Bob Nelson telling a ghost story.
Somewhere in the conversation, they said, if and when you decide that you can't live here anymore, take care of yourself, or you need to move out, will you call us? We would love to buy your home. And she said, I will do that. Sure enough, a few years went by. I'm not sure how long. She called them and said, I have to move out. Are you still interested in my home? And they said, yes, Ellen, we would love to buy your home. And so they got everything done and moved into the home, thanked Ellen. She came over there and saw them. A few years passed, and they didn't hear from Ellen anymore. They learned, I think it was from one of the sons, that Ellen had passed away, and they thanked him for letting them know. And they expressed their sorrow about that because they loved Ellen. And sometime later, I'm not sure whether it was months or years, they were in the kitchen on a very calm, quiet Saturday morning having breakfast. And I think it was the oldest daughter blurted out, has anyone been seeing Ellen? And it was a sigh of relief. Yes. Oh, yes. They all recounted she was here and this is when. And they felt great because it was not a bad thing. It was great. And that was that. And they would just got used to seeing Ellen come by every now and then in the evening or in the morning. She would just, kind of flash through the kitchen or in the living room when my brother would be up late working. One night, my brother was having a hard time sleeping. He said he was kind of restless, and he kind of woke up and rubbed his eyes and looked at the foot of the bed. And there was Ellen with two people whose faces he didn't recognize. And his first instinct was to, be angry and shout out, but, she was a friend of theirs. He took a deep breath and he said, Ellen, you are welcome anytime. No friends. And they didn't really see Ellen much after that.
What I like about that story is, and I hear these stories a lot, and I'm sure you do too, of where people are not, they're not terrified by these people. There aren't even people who are hiding their change or car keys. They're just a presence. Do you hear that a lot? And they're friendly enough, they have a kind of relationship, or they have a sense of some relationship with these things.
I hear that a lot from students who are collecting ghost stories and people who are telling me ghost stories, that there's sort of a sense of camaraderie, especially when there's a perceived shared interest. We love this home. She loved this home. She's here because she loves this home. It's sort of like you're on a team together with your family ghost. And I think it's a way to express that. It's an additional way to express your appreciation for the place and the history of a place. And the ghost becomes sort of a manifestation of that place's meaning and history. And I know I've talked to a lot of people who don't want to live in brand new houses because there are no friendly ghosts there yet. Right? There's no sense of that manifestation of history.
Yeah. Lori sends this email. She says, I found about 1 in 10 people have a fantastic ghost story that really happened to them. But because these things don't really happen, she says, and can't be explained, they do not share what has happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree with that. I think I'll go on record. I'm older, so I'll go on record. I've seen a lot of ghosts. And so I definitely believe in ghosts, and I want to share a really short one because I think it'll give an example of what I'm talking about. It actually happened to my husband, not me. We went to visit some people. We had never met them. We were invited. The lady had a whole bunch of children. We were in the living room. All of her children and her grandkids were in the kitchen, so you could see over there. And my husband turns to the woman and he says, "Well, who's that one boy that's standing there?" And all the rest of the kids had slowly left the kitchen. He didn't know her, nothing. And she said, "Well, what does he look like?" And he described him. And she said, "How old is he?" And he told her. And she said, "Oh, that's the boy that I lost 5 or 6 years ago. He always comes to family get-togethers." Yeah. Oh. But the proof is he didn't know them. Yeah. And he saw him, and when he turned back, it was gone. So I think that's what that lady's talking about, are the personal stories they're afraid to share because it's really happened to them. You can't go back. Once you've seen him, you can't go back.
Lynn, what do you, yeah. it's a lot of people, they don't, they're reluctant because they don't want to be made fun of or something.
I think that's it. I think there's a general perception that, you know, oh, the people who sort of buy whole hog into this idea that we're constantly surrounded by this other dimension that's intersecting with ours at all times. People know how that sounds, you know, and they kind of don't want to be labeled with that brush. So we hear a lot of caveats being given when someone tells a story. Now, I was awake and I was sober and I didn't know these people. And I, you know, and we hear that because it's an emphasis on the rationality. It's sort of a qualifier of I'm a sane thinking person. I know how this is about to sound, but I'm going to tell you anyway. And even the family who didn't want to share with each other until one of them had the guts to say it, I think is a good example of that.
I find that all the time. People come on the tour and they start non-believers, but they will end the tour and always come up to share their stories. And after listening to me tell the stories, we always say you don't have to believe in ghosts to enjoy a good ghost story.
Yeah.
And never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Mm-hmm. Nanette Watts, a guide with Salt Lake City Ghost Tours. Thanks very much for being with us. Linda Dunning, the author of Ghost Lights. It's the fourth in her Utah History and Haunting series. Thank you for being with us. Lynn McNeil teaches folklore at Utah State University. Thank you very
much.
Again, thank you very much for those of you who've shared. If we didn't get to your story, we'll put it on our website so we can share it with others. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Adam Sherlock, by the way. We've been playing some of his music. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.